Hi, this is Tiffany Bova. Welcome to a reload of the What's Next podcast. This is one of my favorite episodes, and I always like to bring those ones back that had a huge impact, not only on myself, but I got a lot of feedback from listeners just like you. I hope you enjoy this week's reload of the What's Next podcast. Hi, this is Tiffany Bova. Welcome to the What's Next podcast, where I have the absolute pleasure in welcoming Maria Konnikova today. She was born in Moscow, moved to the U.S. when she was four. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard, earned her doctorate in psychology from Columbia, and has written two New York Times bestsellers, The Confidence Game and Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Her third book, The Biggest Bluff, should be out in 2019, will be about trying to learn how to play high-stakes poker. While she had zero poker experience before her trip to Las Vegas in the fall of 2016, that isn't the case today. After winning her first tournament at Planet Hollywood, she used the winnings to buy into high-stakes daily tournaments at Aria. Her first major event cash was in April 2017 at the Monte Carlo Casino in Monaco. And now Maria is now a poker champion, having won the PCA National Championship and a second place finish at the Asia Pacific Tour Macau event. Welcome to the podcast, Maria.
Thank you so much for having me, Tiffany.
I love that it was like, Aria. I just love that hotel. And then
my favorite.
Yeah, I love everything about it. And then the Monte Carlo Casino in Monaco, I remember the first time I ever went there, I was like 13, and I was like, this is so cool. I really, really loved it. But welcome to the podcast. And I just can't wait to dig into everything about what you've been up to over the last couple of years. But before we do that, I like to do something called bullish and bearish, which is an opportunity just for me to get the guests a little loosened up. Bullish if you're really for something, bearish if you're not, and then the freedom to fall in between, of course. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The first one, bullish or bearish? Virtual reality casinos will take over some of the business from regular casinos.
I don't know about that. I have to say, if I had to pick one, I'm bearish, but I'm mixed because I do think there's something about live poker. I don't actually gamble, so I don't play any other casino games. But there's something about live poker, and there's something about the energy, I think, for gamblers of a casino that can't really be replaced when you're by yourself and not in that environment. That said, I'm also someone who doesn't play much online and don't actually participate in a lot of online games. And so I'm guessing that if you had someone here who did, you know, a lot of virtual reality games, someone who was into esports, they would say the opposite. And because of the rise of esports, I think that the business side of my mind says I should be bullish, but the other side of me says I'd like to be bearish.
I'm with you. I think the people side of playing poker is part of the fun, but that's just me.
And exactly.
Probably I'm with you in that camp. All right, the next one, bullish or bearish? And this was from a Twitter feed that you had. So bullish or bearish on a cashless society?
Definitely incredibly, incredibly bearish. I think it is a terrible idea. I think that people underestimate all of the security risks, all of the privacy risks, everything it will do to displace already marginalized people. I just think it's absolutely terrifying. I really hope it reverses. I don't see that happening. But, this was something that's been terrifying to a lot of people for a lot of time. I think most people these days are familiar with The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood. I actually haven't watched the show, but I remember reading the book for the first time a number of years ago and saying, oh, wow, that's how you take over society. And one of the reasons that her dystopian scenario was able to happen was because it was a cashless society. And so what ended up happening was you could just freeze people's accounts and freeze people's money of everyone who you didn't want to advance in society, and that way stop their means of escape and stop their means of existence. And the fact that that is becoming more and more possible in reality, I think, is absolutely frightening. So there's no in between here. I'm as bearish as they come.
Yeah, boy, passionate about that one. Take note. All right, the third one, bullish or bearish? Game theory should be taught
in school and sort of before college, right? Because so, you know, it's just not sort of in the more formative years.
Absolutely bullish. I think that as I've learned game theory, so I'm someone who is very late to game theory. I don't have an economics background. I don't have a mathematics background. I mean, I'm a humanities person. In school, in high school, all of my electives were creative writing and French literature and, you know, those types of things. And my senior year, I didn't even take a science. So I'm very much in that direction. But having learned it, I think that it is such a crucial way of thinking. And I'll even go a step further. I think that poker should be taught in elementary school because it's a way of applying game theory. And I think that it will make it much more palatable and much easier for children to learn. And I actually think that for real life, there's nothing quite like it in terms of preparing you to think strategically and to realize how other people are thinking, what they're thinking about. It's just incredibly important decision-making skills that can make your life much better.
Well, I wonder if the, you know, the parents would be like, we don't want our children to be taught poker because that has all kinds of, you know,
Negative, right?
So maybe we go with game theory applied to Go Fish.
Well, you know what? one of the reasons that I'm writing this book is to dispel that conception, because traditionally, you're absolutely right. Poker has been viewed as gambling and as this horrible vice. And to be perfectly honest, that's how I thought of it before I knew what it was up until a few years ago in my mind, because that's always how it's portrayed in culture and that's it's played in casinos. And chess is kind of the nice game, the good game. But honestly, poker is such a better game for learning about life and actually learning good decision-making skills. And one of the reasons, one of the things I hope to accomplish with my book is to dispel that and to show people that actually, no, poker is not gambling, and poker is a really powerful tool that will make your kids much better. Honestly, it's one of the reasons. So now one of the other things that's happened in the last few months is I've become a sponsored player for PokerStars. So one of the reasons that I accepted to join Team Pro is to kind of have an ambassador position where I can spread the message of poker further than I'd otherwise be able to do. And I think that it's very important to kind of cure people of that, quite frankly, puritanical approach to games like that. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I'm definitely going to do my best. And I hope that having someone like me, you know, with a PhD, with a very different background, you know, writer for The New Yorker, someone who's never gambled a second in my life, hopefully that will help change the image a little. But honestly, I don't know. I think it's an uphill battle, but one that I'm definitely willing to fight.
Well, so, and I think that that's what's so fascinating. You know, I've had some amazing thinkers on the show, and, you know, you included, but what really attracted me to having you was this wonderful balance between strong academia, which I want to dig into, and then this whole uncovering, I guess, of your newfound love around kind of game theory that led you to poker, or vice versa. So maybe you can start with, I guess, you know, the story is, you know, when you finished The Confidence Game, one of your previous books, you know, you sort of found yourself at this crossroads. So maybe you can step our listeners through kind of what happened at that point, and then what led you to this new journey you're on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm not going to get into too much detail about some of the personal stuff, because that's a lot of the book is kind of the personal journey. But, you know, I just had a lot of things go wrong after The Confidence came out. And don't get me wrong. I mean, The Confidence Game launch was wonderful. It hit the New York Times bestseller list. I'm not complaining about that. But then afterwards, a lot of things just personally in my life didn't go well. And I started thinking a lot about the nature of luck and what role it plays in our lives and how much of our lives we're actually able to control. And decided that I really wanted to write about this, but needed a way into the topic because it's such a broad topic. And you can't just say, oh, I'm going to write a book about the nature of luck, because that's asking for trouble. There's no narrative. There's no nothing. So I just started reading a lot, which is what I always do when I'm embarking on a new project. It's always my first step is just to immerse myself in different literature. And one of the things I happened to read, because when one of my more mathematically minded friends heard that I was thinking about chance and skill and all of these things, said, you should look into game theory, John von Neumann, you know, very cool dude who created it. I was like, oh yeah, I know who he is. Let me read his book. So I started reading Theory of Games and realized that game theory was actually born from poker. So von Neumann, who's I think one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century, just completely revolutionized society. The computer wouldn't exist without him. He thought that if you could solve poker, you could solve some of the most complex human decisions in the world. And so he created game theory as a way to solve poker. And poker is still not solved. He wasn't actually able to do it. It's such a complicated game. But he created this framework, this game theoretical framework. And when I read that, I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. I need to learn more about this game. This seems like it could actually be a way into the topic for me. And so I started reading about poker and I decided, let's try this. This could actually be a narrative that could force me to have kind of a streamlined story, a way of telling the story that can also incorporate all of the other kind of more psychological, philosophical, existential issues I want to deal with, but in a narratively interesting way. And I didn't know if it was going to work, but here we are. And I think, you know, this is one of those rare instances where you embark on a new book project and you realize that the metaphor that you chose is even better than you had thought it would be. The possibilities are even wider. So I've been incredibly lucky, there's the word luck, that I happen to stumble into something that's just a gold mine in terms of the nuance that it can lend into an exploration of the questions I'm interested in.
Well, I would tell you that I often say this, and it's not mine. The first time I heard it, and people who listen to this podcast will hear me mention this quite a bit, and I really should dig into where the source was, but I heard it from Oprah, but I think she heard it from somebody. So I have to find where she heard it, right? But luck being opportunity and preparedness meeting.
So I don't think that that's completely correct, to be perfectly honest, because I think that a lot of people say that, you know, luck is preparation plus opportunity, right? It's actually, I don't know if you're going to find the source of that quote, because it's something that appears over and over and over. Yeah, exactly. It's one of these truisms, but I don't actually think that that's luck. So the way that I look at luck, luck is just chance. It's the noise in the environment. It's just random variance in your life. It has, sure, to take advantage of chance, you have to be prepared for sure. You can't, you know, you have to have gotten to that point, and you do need preparation, and you need to be in the place where that chance happens. But luck is something else. It's that third thing. It has nothing to do with how prepared you are, really. It just exists. If you're prepared, you're more able to take advantage of it when it comes. But let's look at the flip side of that. So like if someone's hit by lightning, that's also luck. That's bad luck.
Yeah, I would call it bad luck.
What the hell?
I mean, unless you live and get superpowers, then I'd say that was good luck.
Right. But you know, what in the world does preparation and opportunity have to do with it? Zero. And it's the exact same thing, right? If you're walking down the street and you get, you know, a brick falls on your head, that, and you die, that is luck. That was just, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. I don't care how smart you are. I don't care what opportunities you have. That's the exact same thing as you launching a business that succeeds because you happen to launch it at the exact same time that people decide they want this product. And you know, that if something had happened that was positive, people are like, oh, preparation and opportunity. But I think the way that you isolate what luck actually is by looking at the negative side, because no one would ever, I mean, it's insane to say, oh, well, that was preparation and opportunity. And you're describing the identical.
Yeah. And so I want to, which I think that that's a great clarification. I think the bad luck side of it is what throws that off because you clearly couldn't prepare for lightning. I mean, right.
And honestly, and even the good luck side, like if someone wins the lottery, right? Sure, they bought the ticket. You can't win the lottery without buying the ticket. But that has nothing to do with who they are or what they are. That's also luck. And that's going to happen. You know, that's just chance. Absolute. Just, it's a statistical question. It's not a personal question. what I always like to say to people is statistics doesn't care about individuals. You care about individuals. Statistics doesn't care.
You know, what I also really found fascinating when I was doing some sort of, you know, background on you was that you made a comment about getting into poker and being an outsider. And mm-hmm. I get asked this question a lot, right? Like, Tiffany, we're really struggling on changing the business. You know, we're, you know, our culture is set. You know, innovation is happening much faster. Disruption is happening much faster. Like, oh, I just can't get out of it. You know, and so then some people will say, well, you need to bring in new talent, quote unquote, right? So maybe a CEO from the outside to bring this new perspective and, you know, not have this mindset.
Right.
And I'd love for you to share how you have felt being a, you know, I'm using your terms, right? Kind of the outsider has actually given you this great perspective and almost an advantage on the luck side, right? If we're going back to what we were just talking about. So,
Right. Well, I actually think there's a lot to that. I think it's easy to overestimate if you're someone who says, oh, we can only use outsiders, it's easy to go in the other direction. But I do agree with you that it's often incredibly useful to bring out a different perspective. And if you look at people who've kind of, if you look outside of poker, if you look at, you know, people in all sorts of different areas, oftentimes the people who end up being the true innovators or the ones whose names we remember didn't have a linear career path. They're not the ones who worked their way up. Sometimes they are. Obviously, like I said, there are exceptions and it's easy to go into the totally opposite direction. But oftentimes they're people who just came from a totally different area. I'm not even talking about a different company because they were able to look at different issues. They were able to see things in different ways because their mind wasn't used to thinking in one specific way. And I think that's where the true advantage comes, because your mind becomes more flexible because you're not hemmed in by the conventions. You don't know how you're quote unquote supposed to think and act in certain situations. You don't know what the established wisdom is. And that's what's really helped me in poker, is not having any preconceptions and being free to use my knowledge from totally different areas, from being a writer, from studying psychology, because there's no one on my shoulder saying, this is how you're supposed to play this hand. But because I'm studying it and I'm learning it, I'm now seeing what the supposed to actually translates to. But because I haven't ever felt the pressure to play that way, I can observe it from the outside and then play the way that I kind of feel I should be playing and not the way that I feel like I need to play because of certain, you know, expectations, for instance. So I think that it can be incredibly valuable. And also, honestly, having just broad life experience, I think, is good for any career. You know, I often say, like, if you're considering taking a gap year between high school and college or between college and going to work and you can actually afford it, this is a luxury that I could never afford. And I think a lot of people can't. But if you can afford it, if you're even considering it, do it. You know, get life experience. Try to do things before you settle into a path. And also, don't be afraid if it doesn't feel right to change. I have changed directions so many times, and a lot of times people have thought I was totally crazy for doing it because it seems like I'm giving up a lot of stability, a lot of things that are, you know, expected of me, but also a lot of just positive, to speak in game theory language, positive expected value, because you know what your career path is, you know exactly how much you'll be earning, et cetera, et cetera. Why would you give that up for a complete unknown? But every time I've made a choice like that, I think I've done it for the right reasons. And it's always, at least until now, knock on wood, worked out, because I think it's good not to feel like you have to make life choices based on expectations or based on already being on a certain path and thinking, oh, well, it's too late. I already made this decision. A lot of people don't realize that basically any decision, as long as you're still alive, any decision can be undone and you can do something else and you're allowed to do that. It's not like you're breaking some sort of rules. They're just,
yeah. And I did the same thing in my 30s. I changed jobs every 18 months and my sort of, you know, friends would be like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? You know, you're giving up all this, you know, tenure and established. And you know what, really quite honestly, I didn't know why, I didn't know what the end game was. And it was definitely not linear. I was not going up, up. It sometimes it was sideways. Sometimes it was backwards. But I started saying this now only in retrospect that I didn't realize that I was just absolutely trusting the process, wherever that was going to take me. And then in my 40s, had I not done everything in my 30s, I wouldn't have actually been as valuable, quote unquote, as an employee to hire had I not had all those experiences that everyone thought I was making a mistake on, you know. And then and then landing in, you know, at a company where I had to be a lot more academic, which I am not. And I and like writing and all the things I was really uncomfortable with that totally stretched me into a new area. But I think if I had had the plan, like, okay, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do that. And then it's just disappointing, most likely. Right.
Yeah, for sure. No, I completely agree with you. I think that it's crucial to not necessarily think, you know, okay, this is the plan. Because as soon as you start thinking about that, right away, you also have expectations and you also have like a path, like I must do this and then that in order to reach point C. I don't think you should just go crazy and start doing random things just to mix things up. There should be a reason you're doing it. But it doesn't have to have any sort of grand, I'm trying to get to point Y. One of the things that you learn in psychology is that no matter what you do or what you think, you are so bad at predicting what point Y even looks like, because the us of today has no idea what the us of even a year from now, let alone 10 years from now, is going to be like and is going to want. And so we're making decisions for, you know, for the you that you are right now, and not for the you that you will be in 10 years. And you don't realize that you're like, oh, no, no, I know what I'm going to want in 10 years. But the truth is you don't. And so I think that having that flexibility, that mental flexibility, and actually, so this is one of the wonderful things about poker and one of the things that I'm really trying to explore in the book. And I think one of the reasons that I've found that I'm actually, you know, that I have some sort of talent in poker that I had no idea that I had is I've always been very comfortable with uncertainty. And that's something that the human mind often struggles with, because I've studied so much about how much we struggle with it. I think I've been very open to it, because you have to realize that life is all about uncertainty. And so freeing yourself up to that, realizing that you can't predict the future, that you can only make the best decision that you possibly can in the present, and then happen what may, you know, just be happy that you made the right decision right now, even if, you know, you can't predict its consequences many, many months, many years down the line. I think it's always a mistake to make a decision now, not because it's the right decision right now, but because you think it's going to be the right decision for something that you want in 10 years. I think that's a fault that a lot of people, and I'm guilty of doing that sometimes too. And I think that's something that we have to try to avoid.
Yeah. And I tweeted something maybe, I don't know, it had to be 6 or 7 months ago now. And then I posted it on LinkedIn, and I said, you know, in my 20s, obviously it was in a tweet, so it was fairly short. It was like, you know, my 20s, it was like my career path, right? In my 20s, what do I want to do? In my 30s, it was how much money can I make? In my 40s, it's like, really, is this what it's all about? And then in my 50s, it has been, you know, I want to try and give back. What was interesting about that is, you know, Adam Grant has one as well that sort of talks about this whole sort of personal path, right? And I think, and I got tons of feedback. I mean, it was probably one of my most active, crazy enough, like tweets and LinkedIn posts, where the millennial generation is almost doing it in the flip. You know, they're trying to give back sooner, and then, you know, unless a family starts younger, or, you know, and so it's not quite as consistent, where generationally everybody, like everything you just said and what I just shared, where generationally, you know, millennials were getting a lot of flack for changing jobs all the time.
Yeah.
Where in my generation, people are like, oh my God, you know, and now it's just kind of expected. So you see these differences. But, you know, I wanna get a little deeper into the psychology side of what you've done as well, because I think the things you're pointing out now, if you were to take you know, what you've learned from game theory, poker, the experience with psychology, right? And obviously your degrees and, you know, everything from an education standpoint. And you were to turn back in and you were standing in front of a, you know, a group of business leaders that were saying, God, you know, this is getting crazy. Growth is getting harder. Our customers are more demanding. You know, these new competitors are popping up everywhere. Like, you know, we just don't even know where to begin.
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
You know, I would, I think part of what we've been talking about being willing to just make good decisions right now and being willing to change, I think is crucial. So here's one of the things I learned actually in my previous book. I wrote about this bias in the confidence game, but it's something that I'm learning even more now, but it's one of the reasons why cons succeed. And that's because people have a tendency to not want to change once they've already invested significant resources into something, whether those resources are financial, whether they're beliefs, whether they're emotional, it doesn't really matter. If you've already invested a lot, it is really difficult to change your mind or to get you to change your strategy.
Right.
So the sunk cost fallacy is one term for it, but the sunk cost fallacy, I don't think even goes broad enough, but that's a good psychological way of thinking about it. You've already sunk costs into it that could be, like I said, they don't actually have to be physical costs, but they often are. And then you can't actually deviate from that. So a lot of these businesses that come to you and say, you know what, I want this advice, all this stuff is changing. When you give them
the advice you should be giving them, which is often, you know, you need to scrap this multi-billion-dollar infrastructure because, or multi-million dollar, depends on the size of the business we're talking about, and start fresh and actually do this and say, you know what we've been doing, what's been working for the last 10 years, 20 years, however long, is no longer working. We need to start from point zero. And here are the things. Let's imagine you're starting the business in this environment. What are you going to think about? What are you going to do? How would you structure it? They would balk at that. They say, oh, haha, very funny. Right. We're never going to take that advice
right.
because you can't ask someone to tear down completely. They want to make incremental changes instead. They want to say, oh, well, maybe we should do X, not Y. So one of my favorite studies that I wrote about in the Confidence Game was from Harvard Business School, I want to say, might have been Stanford Business School. Anyway, it was from a very good business school, from business school students. And so the professor gave them this sort of business dilemma, and it was about building airplanes and how much you could expect from different, I'm going to forget the specifics, so I'm not going to tell you kind of what the exact problem was, but the basic idea was you can choose different sorts of airplanes and airlines that have different sorts of payoffs, they have different fuel efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. How are you going to allocate your money? And so they made that decision, they kind of allocated funds towards the different choices. And then they say, okay, now it's 5 years later, the business landscape has changed completely. Here are your new considerations. And there's a very clear answer that you're actually supposed to, that the airlines, the airplanes that were good before are now bad, and you actually have to really change your strategy. What ends up happening is that they all keep the same strategy. And it's the same. There was another study done with these business school students. Yeah, no,
not surprised.
You laugh, and I just, when I saw this, I was like, oh my God, there was another study that's saying, you know, you've been working on this new technology for X amount of time, you've invested Y amount of resources, and you've just found out that a competitor is actually about to come out to market with a better version of your product. What are you going to do? The correct answer is scrap it, you know, take my sunk costs and realize that I need to do something else. No one does that. Everyone says, well, we're going to wait the 2 years and maybe, you know, maybe they'll fail. Maybe their product isn't actually better. Maybe ours will somehow still be okay. Where the entire premise of the product was they had to be first and it had to be best. So that happens over and over and over. And people, when you say things like this, like when you and I are talking, they'll be like, oh yeah, I totally see that. I would never do that myself. Then when it's their money, their company, their business, their reputation on the line, of course they're going to do it themselves. And it's frustrating. And yet it's human, right? Can you actually fault them for it a lot of the time?
No. And I always tell people, look, change is hard. And I think, you know, and I use myself because that's always a great example. It's like, you know, by January 10th, I'm over my New Year's resolution.
Oh my God. So I'm someone who exercises regularly. I do yoga every day, but I also will go to the gym to do other things to supplement the yoga. And it's hilarious. Like clockwork, the week after New Year's is, you can't get a machine. Everything is packed.
Yep.
Everyone is there with their New Year's resolutions. 2 weeks
Done.
Later, empty.
Crickets. Yeah. So what you should do is just take 2 weeks off those 2 weeks when everybody's, you know, trying to get back
into
it.
Exactly. Exactly. When everyone's in the middle of their New Year's resolutions is when I should be taking my break.
Change is hard. And I say, look, individually change is hard. So imagine being a leader, yeah, whether you have one person, three people, 300, 3,000, 30,000 people in your company, if you're a CEO of a multinational brand, and getting everybody to change in some way.
Absolutely.
Slightly, right? So from a psychology standpoint, you know, what I also find very fascinating about poker, and I don't play competitively, although, it is my game of, choice. When I
Excellent.
Go to Vegas and I set little goals for myself, like, okay, if I can earn this much money, as soon as I have that much, I'm going to go mm-hmm. buy whatever it is I want to buy, because I won't spend my own money.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't count the fact that I've lost a lot to get the money instead of just going and buying it, because that's not fun. Like, you just got to count the winnings and forget the losing, right? Okay. So I'm never positive.
Mental accounting is
right?
such a beautiful thing.
Like, it's totally
thing,
justification. You know, you could have just walked over and gotten it for half the price had you just spent the original amount. Anyway, I digress. But I'm not playing competitively, but I do pay a little bit of attention because, you know, you're not talking while you're playing for the most part. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people are really serious about playing, even if they're not playing competitively, where they're not very chitter chattery, right? And then you get some tables where they're too chattery. But you know, is the nonverbal cues around this sort of communication style as well, right? Because you almost have to communicate, and I'm not specifically talking about in poker because you're trying not to communicate at all, but using those skills, around influencing with the body language, right? And just the way in which you present yourself and all the things that come with that. And I think that that's part of the psychology of it all as well, when you're trying to lead companies to change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, there's actually a lot of work that's been done that shows that nonverbal communication skills are actually oftentimes more persuasive and more powerful at communicating than verbal ones, than actual words. So there's some work that's been done on, for instance, you take stage actors and you take a play that's been recorded and you make the audio content basically unintelligible. And then you play the video for people, and then you have other people actually watch it like a normal play. And then you look at what they've taken away and what they're able to kind of see. And you actually see that the ones who've watched the garbled content are better able to pick up on a lot of intention. They know exactly what's going on. Oftentimes they have better interpretations of the drama because they can actually see, you know, what the author quote unquote intended, because they're reading all of that context. And I don't think we realize just how much we're always communicating, even when we're not communicating, and how much other people are communicating. And I think the people who end up being the best leaders, the best negotiators, who end up getting kind of ahead in a lot of situations where you want to say, oh my God, he just got so lucky. Well, no, he actually is much, or she is much better able to pick up on those nonverbal cues and to control your own nonverbal cues so that you're able to persuade big groups of people. Because even though it's difficult and organizational change is so incredibly difficult, we do have some counterexamples in history of big companies making big changes, radical changes, when people have thought that they were going to go under completely. So it is possible, but I think it does take, in that particular case, it's not a specific organization. I think in that case, it's that the organization got very lucky to have a leader who is insanely talented, who has those skills, and frankly, who has the charisma to be able to make it happen. In those cases, you see businesses that you thought were going to go bankrupt just make huge comebacks and end up doing incredibly well.
And I think, the ones that I've taken a look at, it is a charismatic leader, right, that has to kind of set the vision, but it happens from the bottom up, right? I mean, if everybody isn't sort of organized around the cause and the fight and, you know, all the things that they want to have done, you just have no shot of turning that around. Mm-hmm. And I think that today that is more true than ever, because I think people and companies, small businesses especially, you know, it's just getting much more difficult. And, you know, learning how to be a leader who can drive change, who can send the right verbal and nonverbal cues, who can create a culture and an environment that welcomes failure, because then that's the way to success.
Yep.
You know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's just not taught in school. Going back to teaching game theory, whether it's poker or Go Fish, which that's debatable. I gotta say, Go Fish might be the way, but
maybe Go Fish and
okay, let's go with
then
that.
You move up to poker in first grade.
In the middle.
We can meet in the
middle. But, I think this goes to it. I had Roger Martin on a couple of times ago, and he was the dean at, a well-known Canadian MBA school. And we had this whole conversation around, the future of education to match the future of work, right? That education is still sort of educating to the 20th century business and speed of business and sort of the kinds of technologies we had at our disposal. And now we're in the 21st century. And you have these little smaller schools that are trying to really push the envelope by using all those things. But the broad-based masses, right, are getting the same education. They're learning history, they're learning, whatever they're learning. Not a whole lot of music, not a whole lot of art, limited science, technology, and engineering, depends where you are in the country, right, or in the world. And these kinds of much more softer skills. And so, maybe we can wrap this up because you have had a fantastic educational, foundation, right, through your education and your degrees. You've written books, so you've studied a lot of stuff. Now the poker, I think, which I still have to say, is just the most fascinating part of this whole thing because I think it threads it all together. And so what do you think education, for those listening who have kids in school or could get them into new classes or go take a class themselves, what would you say would be the best thing to do?
Well, as I said earlier, I do feel strongly that everyone should learn poker, but really learn it, not just play and be like, oh, hey, this is a cool game. Let me just bluff all the time or let me do this. Actually study it and actually figure out what's going on so that you have someone good teaching you, who teaches you decision theory, who teaches you all of the things that's going on, because you're not just going to be learning, how game theory works and how to make decisions. You're also going to be learning emotion management, self-control, self-regulation, creativity. You're going to be learning a lot of these things. But poker aside, I think that we need to go back in history a little bit and go back in time where people weren't oriented towards, oh, I need to learn practical skills. I think everyone just needs to learn, have a broad humanities background. I think you need to read fiction. You need to read poetry. You need to get curious about the world, period. And the world isn't just, computer programming or the sciences or, physics, something that has obvious practical value. The world is so much broader, and the best thinkers are ones who are able to be curious about it more broadly. And so I would just encourage parents to encourage their children to take those kinds of classes and not to think, oh my God, what am I going to be able to do with a comparative literature degree? Instead, think, oh my God, look at all the things I'm going to learn from a comparative literature degree. I mean, I studied fiction as an undergrad. I studied creative writing. It's not like I was studying, and I come from a family with no money whatsoever. So it's not like I could fall back on anything. I knew I'd have to make my own way in the world. But I think that the best thinkers just say, you know what, I want a broad introduction to the world, because they're people who are curious about everything. So anything that gets your children curious, anything that keeps their worldview and their views in general broad, I think that's the key.
Well, this has been so awesome, Maria. I hope you had as much fun as I did. I could just keep talking about, all of this, because I think it's such a unique perspective. And, I'm sitting here going, how can I just go play poker full time? Which is probably not a good idea for me right now, but it's a good goal to have.
It's a great goal to have, honestly.
Because I am on the negative side of poker, right? So then I can't afford to do it. It has to be a hobby for me unless I get really serious about it. But it has been a pleasure having you today. So we really all look forward to your next book coming out, The Biggest Bluff. Any idea when that's going to be published?
We don't have a date yet. We're hoping for around the fall of 2019.
Excellent. Well, if anybody is in the neighborhood and sees that Maria's playing in a tournament, please go by and support her. And it has just been a pleasure having you. So thank you so much, Maria, for being with us today on the What's Next podcast.
Thank you. This was an absolute pleasure. A lot of fun. A really interesting conversation.
Well, that was an awesome conversation. I don't know if you noticed, but it was a little longer than normal, but I could have just kept going. I was so fascinated by the combination of the psychology degree and her undergrad at Harvard, and then sort of now poker. Like how you pull all that together with these fascinating insights in order to be better leaders and better business change agents and inspiring those to do things differently. I think the whole thing of her being an outsider and not coming with this established set of wisdom may actually be a key to unlocking this unmet potential and unrealized potential within your own companies and as well within your own careers. You know, if we can all do things that make us a little uncomfortable, all the better. And learning is a lifelong journey. What you think you may be doing today may not be what you're doing 12 months from now, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. You just have to give yourself permission to try things that you're interested in and always continue to be a student of whatever it is you're doing in this lifetime. So with that, thank you so much for joining me today on the What's Next podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to share with your friends. And if you wouldn't mind, leave a review and tell me what you think about it. Appreciate you listening today. Look forward to having you join me again soon.